Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike.
This is preeminently the time to speak the truth, the whole truth, frankly and boldly.
History doesn't have to be boring, buttoned up, or inaccessible. And it certainly didn't end in 1945. It belongs to all of us, and we share and add to it every day. Welcome to the History of Go-Go podcast, where I interview interesting guests, cover a motley crew of topics, and it's a place where you can sit, think, and drink all at the same time. I'm your host, Rob Mellon.
Stop thinking and believe in me, beloved Mussolini, and I will restore the glory that was Rome. And the people answered, Duce, Duce.
The greatest intellect in the world can be silenced with this.
My guest today is Professor, New York Times best-selling, and Pulitzer Prize-winning author, Dr. David Kurtzer. He has written several excellent books, including Prisoner of the Vatican and The Pope Who Would Be King. His book, The Pope and Mussolini, The Secret History of Pius XI and the Rise of Fascism in Europe, won the Pulitzer Prize in 2015, and it also won the American Historical Association Prize for the best book in Italian history that same year. His most recent work is The Pope at War, The Secret History of Pius XII, Mussolini, and Hitler. This excellent new work features a trove of newsworthy revelations based on recently unsealed Vatican archives. Of the book, Ian Kershaw, author of Hitler, A Biography, says, "The Pope at War ends much of the debate about Pope Pius XII and surely makes any lingering apologia for his stance implausible." And we are very pleased to have the historian, New York Times best-selling author, and Pulitzer Prize winner with us today. Welcome, Dr. Kurtzer.
Hello there.
In regards to researching this topic, what has changed in terms of documents and correspondence that's been made available in just the last few years? And did Pope Francis have a direct role in the release of that information?
Well, yes. Most dramatically, the Vatican authorized the opening of the archives for the papacy of Pius XII, who was the wartime pope. He reigned from 1939, just before the beginning of the war, until 1958. That decision was made by the current pope. It's up to the current pope, whoever it is, to authorize the opening of the archives of the next papacy whose archives have yet to be opened. And the predecessor of Pius XII, Pius XI, those archives were opened back about a little over 15 years ago. So there's been pressure for decades because of the controversy over the silence of Pope Pius XII during the Holocaust, pressure on the Vatican to open those archives, and Pope Francis finally did open them. I would say one other thing, though, that I think is less well known, and that is that even in the archives that are relevant to this history that have been opened, the various state archives, the fascist archives in Italy, the diplomatic archives in Germany, and in various other countries that had diplomatic relations with the Vatican, they're constantly getting new materials, or many of them are getting new materials declassified and made available. So even in, for example, the National Archives in the United States, there are materials that are only available in the last few years.
Dr. Kurtzer, it is tradition here to accompany the conversation with a special brew. Today, we have Pope's Imperial Pumpkin Ale from the Millersburg Brewing Company of Millersburg, Ohio. This autumn-style beer is brewed with 10 pounds of pumpkin per barrel. It has an orange-brown color with a nose of pumpkin pie, brown sugar, nutmeg, cinnamon, and vanilla. And it is the perfect brew for a crisp fall day. Remember, the best way to enjoy the podcast is with one of our featured beers. This is also my time to ask you to subscribe to the podcast. Subscribing, it's the only way to get the newest material right away. And to our growing legion of listeners and supporters from thousands of cities and towns and 100 countries, I have to say thank you. And today, I'd like to give a very special welcome to our listeners in Providence, Rhode Island. And now, I raise my Pope's Imperial Pumpkin Ale very high. and to all of those throughout history who have stood against tyranny and subjugation, I say cheers. I know your book is called The Pope at War, and it focuses on the papacy of Pope Pius XII during World War II, but could we go back to maybe an earlier time, his upbringing, and some of the early assignments he had as a priest?
Yeah, so Pius XII was from a family known for being part of the Black Aristocracy, the so-called Black Aristocracy, which were the elites in Rome who, for many decades, even centuries, were close to the popes. His grandfather was very close to Pope Pius IX, who, when he fled after the revolution in 1848, the Pope Pius IX fled Rome for a couple of years. And Pacelli, the man who had become pope, his grandfather went into exile with that pope. And when he came back, helped found the Vatican newspaper. And then his father became the principal lawyer for the Vatican, as did his older brother as well. So he grew up, went to a seminary, and had a kind of meteoric career in the church. But interestingly, he never had a pastoral role. He began right away after his ordination working in the Vatican Secretariat of State. And then he was born in 1876, then still as a young man, in 1917, was sent to Germany to be a papal nuncio or a papal ambassador in Germany, and spent 12 years in Germany from 1917 to 1929. So that's when he was called to Rome, made a cardinal by his predecessor, Pius XI, and then quickly appointed Secretary of State, which basically is the number two position in the Vatican, position he served in from 1930 until the time he was elected Pope himself on the death of Pius XI in early 1939.
You mentioned just then that he was the Secretary of State of the Vatican before his election as Pope. Because of that, were the policies that the Vatican had in regards to foreign affairs the same from Pope Pius XI to the 12th, or did they change at all?
Yeah, so that was a big question, really, particularly when Pius XI died and Pacelli is elected, his Secretary of State is elected Pope. He takes the same name, Pius. Now he's Pius XII. So there's a lot of thought, perhaps this means there'd be great continuity, especially since he was Secretary of State, and especially in foreign relations. But that proved not to be the case. And in fact, we know from the archives of Pius XI that when he was Secretary of State, Pacelli did what he could to calm down the rather meteoric temper of the pope he was serving for, and who would lash out, for example, the Nazis or what he took to be their persecution of the church, and tried to plan a different path as pope, which became clear almost from the first day of his papacy.
And as you've mentioned, he had a lot of connections with Germany going back to when he was just a priest. But let's start with Italy itself. When the fascists come to power in Italy, what is the relationship between Mussolini and the Vatican?
Well, it's a very curious one because Mussolini, of course, came from a left-wing socialist background before he became a fascist. And as a young man, had been fiercely anti-clerical and anti-church. But as he founded the fascist movement in 1919, which initially began, by the way, the fascist movement's initial program in 1919 was also anti-clerical, anti-church, but he soon realized that if he was going to come to power and solidify power in a heavily Catholic country like Italy, he would greatly profit from the backing of the Vatican and the church. And so he made a kind of radical change and basically promised the church that if they supported him, he would see that many of the privileges the church had lost with the end of the papal states in the few decades earlier, the separation of church and state, which had been embodied in the new Italian state back in the 1860s, 1870, when Rome was conquered by the Italian troops. This kind of exchange was made where the Pope then, Pius XI, who came to the papacy the same year Mussolini became head of government in 1922, Pius XI realized that Mussolini didn't have a religious bone in his body, but also saw an opportunity here. And so they basically made a deal. Pope threw church support behind the fascist and Mussolini, the fascist government. And Mussolini reciprocated. This was highlighted in 1929 with the signing of the Lateran Treaty. And this, among other things, established Vatican City as a sovereign state, which it had not been, and gave all sorts of privileges to the church, and among other things, ended the separation of church and state in Italy.
In his role as Secretary of State, did Pacelli then have contact directly with Mussolini?
He never met directly with him, and Mussolini never felt very comfortable around priests, much less around the Pope. He met once with Pope in 1932 with Pacelli's predecessor, Pius XI. But Mussolini didn't feel comfortable with priests, but also didn't like to be surrounded by the grandeur of the church, which threatened to kind of eclipse his own charisma. So the dealings between Pacelli and Mussolini when he was Secretary of State were largely through the Italian ambassador of the Holy See, with whom he met weekly. So Mussolini would send his ambassador to meet with Secretary of State Pacelli and bring his requests, and vice versa.
In Germany after World War I, throughout the 1920s, there were several political parties, but the main struggle was between communism and fascism. It seems like the church has to contend with that as well. And almost from the very beginning, communists are against the church. They eliminate the church. Does the communist philosophy become a real target of the church?
Well, even before, I mean, socialism had been targeted from the 19th century by the church as an enemy, godless socialism before godless communism. And certainly with the Bolshevik Revolution, the Bolsheviks taking over, became the Soviet Union in 1917. This was a great, sent up great alarm signals in the church and in the Vatican. So certainly part of the appeal that Mussolini had for the church in Italy was that he was a great foe of communism, so they had an enemy in common.
In 1939, Hitler's power is pretty much solidified in Germany by that point as the Führer. Did Pope Pius ever meet him? If you go back to the time when he was in Germany, did he ever actually have any sort of meetings with Hitler, any correspondence? And then what is that correspondence once he becomes Pope between the Vatican and the Third Reich?
I'm not aware of any meeting or correspondence before he became Pope. He was, however, when I say he was initially nuncio in Germany beginning in 1917, those first few years he was nuncio, he was actually assigned to Munich in Bavaria, the heavily Catholic southern part of Germany. And that's, of course, where at the time Hitler was organizing before he came to power. And so he's certainly very well aware of Hitler, but I don't think there's any evidence that they ever had a meeting or ever had direct correspondence. And certainly Hitler was not the type to appeal to Pacelli. The people he felt most comfortable with when he was in Germany were the conservative Catholic elite, and not someone like Hitler, who, although he had been baptized and was in theory Catholic, certainly was seen as no friend of the Catholic Church. Now, when he became Pope, it's different. One of the discoveries I made in these newly opened archives of the Vatican, kind of an amazing discovery, I think, was that within a few weeks of the election of Pacelli as Pope Pius XII, Hitler saw a great opportunity and so decided to send a secret emissary to initiate secret one-on-one negotiations with the Pope. And those now have come to light with the opening of these archives and with the publication of my book. There, amazingly, not only do we find out about these meetings, but there's essentially a transcript of each of the meetings, of the conversation. The Pope held these conversations in German, in which he was fluent. And apparently he kept a German prelate, German priest, hidden in an adjacent room, writing down the conversations. So that's what we now can find in the newly opened Vatican archives.
There were several influential Catholics who held positions in Nazi Germany. Who were some of the German leaders who had direct dealings with the Vatican?
Well, there were both formal relations. So there was a German ambassador to the Holy See, who initially, when Pius XII became Pope, was a man named Diego von Bergen, who had been actually since the early 20s had been the German ambassador. So before Hitler, he stayed on. Interestingly, after the Nazis came to power, Hitler let him remain there, partly because he probably regarded the ambassador to the Holy See as kind of an insignificant position. later in 1943, in the midst of the war, there'd be a change, and a new man, actually an important figure, his name Ernst von Weizsäcker, who had previously been the number two in the foreign ministry in Germany, became the ambassador to the Holy See. So those are the kind of official lines of communication. But as I mentioned, early on in the first month, practically, of the papacy in 1939 of Pius XII, Hitler decided to send a secret emissary. That man was named von Hessen, Philip von Hessen, who was from one of the most aristocratic families in Germany. His great-grandmother was Queen Victoria of England. His grandfather had been Emperor of Germany. And he himself was married to the daughter, one of the daughters of the King of Italy. And so he was sent as the emissary. And he was a man who was quite close to Hitler. Hitler really trusted him. And so he became this go-between between Hitler and the Pope.
What do we know of Pius's views specifically on Judaism? I know that there was some criticism that he quashed a papal denunciation of Kristallnacht, for example. Is that accurate? And do we know of his views on Judaism? Was that uncovered in your research?
Well, the Vatican and the Pope at the time, who was his predecessor while he was Secretary of State, never denounced Kristallnacht. It's not known. I don't think it's well documented that he didn't because of Pacelli telling him not to or advising him not to. But there's certainly no indication that Pacelli, before he became Pope, was inclined to try to antagonize the Nazis in that way by public denunciation. So, what do we know about his attitude toward the Jews? He shared in the general attitudes, rather negative attitudes towards Jews that were prevalent in the Vatican and had been for centuries, really. Of course, he was not happy with the Holocaust and he never favored the mass murder of the Jews. But on the other hand, for example, in 1938, Mussolini instituted the so-called racial laws, which were these anti-Semitic laws that basically threw almost all Jews out of their work, out of their jobs, threw all Jewish children out of the schools. And Pacelli, and then later when he became Pope, never opposed those racial laws, except, importantly, when they were applied to people that the church regarded as Christians, that is, Jews who had been baptized or descended from Jews.
With the fascist proclivity for political violence and the Vatican during World War II surrounded by fascists, Pius XII must have felt that the church was in real danger of maybe even survival.
Well, yes, I think in understanding the attitude that the Pope took during World War II, you have to understand, particularly that at the beginning of the war, and actually for the first few years of the war, it seemed quite likely that Hitler was going to win the war. And so Pius XII thought it was his first responsibility to protect the church in a Europe that was dominated by Hitler with his pal Mussolini. And so, if he was not eager to criticize or antagonize Hitler or Mussolini, certainly this played a major role. And then when Mussolini is overthrown and Italy tries to get out of the war in the summer of 1943, Hitler floods German troops through the Italian peninsula, and they take over most of the peninsula as the Allies had in July of 43 landed troops in Sicily and begin to very slowly work their way up the Italian peninsula. But Rome is now occupied and would be for 9 months between 43 and 44 by German troops. And so now the Pope is also concerned about protecting Vatican City, protecting the church in an Italy and a Rome that's occupied by the German military.
Could the silence of Pope Pius and the Catholic Church during World War II, the criticism that is levied against the church, because the fascists are so preoccupied with other enemies that they have, if you follow Nazi ideology, I guess, the progression of that would be that the Catholic Church would eventually be a target. Could it be that the Catholic Church decides to keep quiet while the Nazis are focused on other enemies and problems?
From the Nazi point of view, for much of the war, they're trying to represent themselves as defenders of Christian Europe. And so they don't want to be seen to be oppressors of the church, because who are the enemies from the point of view of the Nazis and the Nazi propaganda? There are two enemies, basically, communists and Jews. And so those are the enemies, at least as they portray them, of the church, communists, obviously, but also they're constantly, one sees this in the Italian fascist press constantly, that they are justifying their anti-Jewish measures by pointing to the demonization of the Jews that popes and church councils have done for centuries. So the attitude, on the one hand, and also one has to differentiate between the attitude of the Italian fascists and the Nazis in Germany. In Italy, of course, there's been this basically establishment of a clerico-fascist state where the deal had been made between Mussolini and the fascists on the one hand and the Vatican and the church on the other. And that was one of mutual support that had lasted more or less two decades. Germany was a very different situation where Hitler saw the church as working against his own influence. For example, Hitler was eager to replace the large number of parochial schools, which were training children in Catholic areas of Germany, to replace them with state schools that would teach the Aryan supremacy and the rest of Nazi ideology rather than Catholic theology. So in Germany, the situation was more complicated. When the war breaks out, the invasion of Poland, the German church, the Roman Catholic Church in Germany supports the war, supports the Axis war, as the church in Italy would do. And I think that's quite telling because the church hierarchy in Italy directly comes under the authority of the Bishop of Rome or the Pope. And even though the Pope assumed the public position of neutrality in the war, not taking either side, the clergy under his authority, really, in Italy, called on all good Catholics to do their Christian duty and join the Axis war.
The Pope, obviously, you said the official position is neutrality, and he's pushing for peace during the war. What are the overtures towards Stalin and the Soviet Union?
Well, they're not really overtures towards Stalin and the Soviet Union. I'm here again. There are two different periods. The first period, of course, the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact that had been made in August 1939, right before the invasion of Poland, where basically they carve up Poland between, on the east, the Soviet Union, and on the west, Nazi Germany. But then, of course, in the spring of 1941, so a little less than 2 years later, the German army marches against the Soviet Union, and now the Soviet Union becomes part of the Allies. And so if we look at the situation after 1941, so most of the war from 41 to 45, the problem, one of the problems the church has and what we need to understand to grasp the attitude of the Pope is that the Allies include the Soviet Union, the great enemy of the church from the church point of view. And so this is going to feature in their desire of the Pope to see a compromise peace rather than see the destruction of Nazi Germany, because of the worry that a total defeat of Germany would result in a triumphant Soviet Union spreading communist influence throughout Europe.
Was there any fear for the Pope's safety? And was there any thought that the Pope could actually leave Rome for a period during the war?
Well, there was a lot of speculation, and we know from the newly opened archives as well that the Pope at times was fearful, had heard rumors that, for example, that after the war, the Germans were going to make the Vatican into a museum, and that, even rumors about plans to kidnap the Pope and take him to Germany. The Allies, though, took advantage of this and, in fact, spread these rumors. So the Allies, on their radio broadcasts and so on, would do all they could to drum up this notion that the Pope was being placed in danger by the Nazis, because what you had in the war was each side was trying to present the other as the enemy of the church and show that their own side, demonstrate that their own side was what was protecting the Christian churches in general and the Catholic Church in particular. So there was also a propaganda war going on here as well. But so the Pope was somewhat concerned about this and expressed this concern periodically to the German ambassador to the Holy See.
I'm guessing that because of the war, the European nations are involved economically, they're tied up into the war, that the church itself, for its own economic viability, had to really develop a strong relationship with the United States. Funding coming from the United States would have been tied up in the war in Europe. Is that accurate?
Yes, in fact, I think that's also important to understand because really from early in the 20th century, the Vatican came to depend primarily on U.S. Catholic support for financially for the Vatican and for the church, the central church offices. So from the point of view of the Pope, you know, he didn't want to offend American Catholics. So he wasn't particularly inclined to ever come out in favor of the Axis anyway, but certainly even if he were, he would have hesitated to do so because he needed to keep the American Catholics happy. And yeah, so this certainly is a factor that weighs on the Pope's mind.
Does he ever travel to the United States?
He actually did. He was, but not when he was Pope, but before he was Pope in 1936, he was Secretary of State. This was quite unusual, the first Cardinal Secretary of State ever to come to North America. He spent about 2 months traveling throughout the whole country, giving talks, getting honorary degrees from Catholic universities, and near the end, actually meeting with President Roosevelt.
Did that trip to the United States bear any fruit diplomatically?
Well, yes, I think it did, because he ended up feeling he had a kind of personal relationship with FDR. And Roosevelt, similarly, when he sometimes would tell Winston Churchill, you know, I've got this special relationship with the Pope, which you don't have, essentially, and justify various proposals on those grounds. Also, right before the war starts, certainly before the U.S. gets involved in the war, FDR, because the U.S. at the time had no diplomatic relations with the Vatican, this would only come after the war. And so he decided to appoint a personal envoy, a man named Myron Taylor, who had been head of U.S. Steel, so a big industrialist, appoint him as his special personal envoy to the Pope. And Myron Taylor would then, over the next years, shuttle back and forth between the president and the Pope. So there really was this direct link between the two.
Was the correspondence between the Pope and FDR part of that recent release?
Well, in fact, a lot of that correspondence was already published by the U.S., so that's not new particularly. What is new is we know now the kind of advice the Pope was getting behind the scenes and how to react to the American requests. Most dramatically, perhaps, when in, I think, the fall of 1942, Roosevelt asked the Pope, does the Vatican have any confirmation about the mass murder of the Jews of Europe that was underway, saying that they in the U.S. had been getting all sorts of indications of this, but it would help to know whether the Vatican had such information. And we know that the Pope then did not confirm this, but what we now know is what was going on behind the scenes, where his main advisor on Jewish affairs, the man he regarded as his main advisor, told him, yes, you know, we have this, a lot of this kind of confirmation, but it would not be a good idea to say so because then the Americans would use it as propaganda against the Nazis and citing us as a source, and that we don't want.
If we take the two sides, it's generally there's a group that's detractors of Pope Pius XII. He didn't do enough. He was too quiet. And then you have those who said he made every effort he could to protect as many people as he could, including many Jews. If we take the detractors first, what's their main arguments and what's the strongest points of their arguments?
Well, I think the strongest point, and here too in my book, I devote a chapter to this, is what happened in Rome itself. On October 16th, 1943, with the roundup of the Jews of Rome and their subsequent death at Auschwitz. So the popes had for centuries, because Rome had been part of the papal states, the Jews of Rome had been considered for Jews, that the Pope was somehow a special protector. Of course, at the same time, the popes were requiring them to be in ghettos and banning all sorts of activities. But there was this somewhat paternalistic attitude. So when the Germans take over Rome in September 1943, they begin to organize the roundup of Jews, and Hitler sends about 350 SS to Rome to do this roundup, which happens on October 16th. They have the SS, the Gestapo has lists of what they take to be all the Jews in Rome and their addresses, and goes house to house with these lists and seizes men, women, babies, children, people in wheelchairs, and herds them onto trucks, which are taken to a military college as a holding area right outside Vatican City, literally at the border of Vatican City. And they would be held there for 2 days while, interestingly, because about 1,260 were rounded up, but just a little over 1,000 2 days later would be put on the train and sent to Auschwitz, where a week later they would arrive there and most of them would be sent directly to the gas chambers. So what happened in those 2 days was they were checking their baptismal credentials because the Nazis didn't want to offend the Pope. And so if those who could prove they'd been baptized, or even, interestingly, men, Jewish men who were married to Catholic women, they were freed. They weren't put on the train to Auschwitz. Meanwhile, the Pope was under great pressure to do something to stop this mass murder of the Jews of Rome. And he did have his Secretary of State call in the German ambassador to the Holy See. But when the ambassador to the Holy See told him, look, this order came from the highest level, namely Hitler, do you really want me to protest it to Hitler? Now, we're not even talking about a public protest, but just this kind of private protest. And the answer of the Secretary of State was, well, no, I didn't say that. You know, that you should know that Pope's not happy about this, but, we're not insisting that you complain to Hitler about it, much less did the Pope take any public action. So if you want, the most flagrant case of where the Pope failed to speak out because he didn't want to offend Hitler, this is really it. And when defenders of him, and of course, there's a large number who want to see him made a saint,
right,
they justify it by saying, oh, he didn't want to make things worse for the Jews, if he had publicly protested. But the Nazis didn't need, and Hitler didn't need any spur to be angrier at Jews or more interested in seeing that every Jew in Europe was murdered. Nothing changed there. So, this is, I think, this is one instance anyway, what has spawned this notion that the Pope really failed morally in this time of extermination, the attempted extermination of the Jews of Europe.
And from that perspective, I can understand his position. He doesn't have any military power. The problem with that is when he doesn't stand on those grounds, no matter what the cost, he's going to be weakened after that, in history, I think. If he would have stood on those moral principles, irrespective of what the consequences would have been, but he's thinking too politically. Is that a fair criticism?
Well, the one category of people that he was, I think, aiming to save in this way were the baptized Jews, which from the point of view of the church were not Jews and shouldn't be treated as Jews. They were Catholics. And so when you look at what was actually done on behalf of, saving people that the Nazis were persecuting and the fascists, it's very largely focused on this category. And to some extent, they are able to, as I mentioned on the roundup of October 16, 1943, by retaining good relations, amicable relations with the Nazis, as well as with fascists in Italy, they're able to some extent to protect Catholics who came descended from Jews or had been converted from Judaism.
So conversely, for his supporters, the staunchest supporters, those who want him to be canonized, what do they say in this regard? What are the strongest points on Pius's side?
Well, I think a lot of their points are totally specious, but if I were to make an argument in favor of Pius or in defense of Pius XII, I would say, look, first of all, it looked in the first years of the war that the Nazis were going to win the war. He had a responsibility as the supreme pontiff of all the faithful worldwide to protect the church and protect its mission in the world, so that he had to make very difficult choices. If they, confine themselves to that argument, I could understand it. I think one could argue whether this was the right decision. But they don't, and one sees instead that, by not publicly condemning the Nazis or the Holocaust, he was able to work behind the scenes and save hundreds of thousands of Jews and so on. This is ridiculous. So that, I think, from my point of view, is the problem, that there's an unwillingness to confront this history in the church, which I think the Vatican reaction to my recent publication of my book in Italy further shows not much has changed there.
You mentioned 1943, the beginning of 1944, the Nazis have control of Rome specifically. But then in June of 44, the U.S. Army shows up, liberates Rome. Does the Pope's position change at that point when he's no longer under direct threat of the Nazis?
Well, that's an interesting question, because you could say that, okay, if you know he's been afraid of what the Nazis would do to Vatican City and so on, this constrained him. Now he no longer has that constraint. Moreover, now it's pretty clear that the Nazis are not going to win the war, so he doesn't have to worry about the future of the church in Europe ruled by the Nazis and the fascists. But now he has a different worry as it becomes clear that Germany's likely to lose the war, and that is that the Soviet Union will be triumphant in Europe, something we mentioned earlier. And this is what preoccupies him, and not just elsewhere, but also in Rome and in Italy itself. The communists are emerging as the main anti-fascist force, including in the resistance during the war. And so he's worried that there'll be basically a revolution in Italy, which will bring the communists to power. And he worries about the future of the Vatican and the church in Italy, not just Europe, but in Italy, dominated by communists. So this is now why he is interested in trying to broker a compromise peace rather than the complete defeat of Germany. But it soon becomes clear to him that when he brings this up, for example, with FDR's envoy to him, Myron Taylor, Taylor tells him, forget it. Churchill and Roosevelt have demanded unconditional surrender, and we're not going to enter into any kind of compromise peace.
So when he hears that, he must think the British and the Americans are then the best choice. He would want them to take over Germany and them to occupy Italy until it was on more stable grounds. Is that accurate?
Well, that's certainly true. I think, though, he was worried, and we know this also from the recently opened archives, kind of the behind-the-scenes discussions, that what's going to happen at the end of the war is that, first of all, Japan would still be in the war. And at this point, the worry was that the U.S. and Britain would turn its attention to Japan, while this would leave more or less the Soviet Union unencumbered in rolling through Europe at the same time as communist parties in Western Europe internally would foment revolution. Secondly, he was worried that it was a weakness of democracies, that democracies, Britain and the U.S. in particular, having one in Europe, would say, we've had enough of warfare, now we need peace dividends. The U.S. would retreat to America and again leave the big military budgets and the military activities under the sway of Stalin and the Soviet Union. So this was the kind of set of worries that the Pope would have had.
In the Vatican today, are there two groups, basically, mainly? One that probably has a more conservative type of agenda, wants to keep those records quiet, doesn't want to speak of any of the criticisms of Pope Pius XII or anything like that, and then another vein that's more interested in being open and transparent. Is there any internal dynamics there in the Vatican like that?
Yes, definitely. And I run into this when I work in the Vatican archives, that some archivists will come up and talk with me and tell me they've read some of my books or articles and share my perspective, and we can kind of trade stories. Others, obviously, are very defensive and refuse, from my point of view, to really engage in this history and its complexity. This relates to a much larger set of debates and arguments and fights going on in the church right now, which is Pope Pius XII, the wartime pope, is the big hero of conservatives in the church. He was the last pope before the Second Vatican Council, which, from the point of view of conservatives in the church, is where the church went wrong. And so if you go, for example, on Twitter any day and put in Pius XII, you'll see all these postings that Pope Francis isn't really the pope, that after Pius XII, there has been no legitimate pope. And that's the most extreme position, but it's held by a kind of worrying number of people. So this puts Pope Francis in an awkward position, that he, of course, has been attacked by right wing in the church. And so I think the question of Pius XII and World War II is not high on his agenda. He has his own priorities, battles that he's fighting. He has enough. He has the right wing of the church angry enough at him, and he probably doesn't figure he needs to get into this this question, even aside from the fact that it would be very rare for a pope to criticize a predecessor pope. It just doesn't happen.
And it seems to me this would be the best opportunity, because after Pope Francis, you don't know the type of papacy that we'll have. It could be conservative like Benedict. So there is an opportunity here, wouldn't you say?
Well, in that sense, yes. But I mean, one thing that also should be said is that some of the national churches, that is the Roman Catholic churches, have begun to come to terms with this history. Most recently, two or three years ago, the German church hierarchy came out with a statement about World War II, saying that they had to come to terms with the fact that the church in Germany had supported the war, the Hitler's war, had never come out against the extermination of the Jews of Europe by the German army and the German forces. The Roman Catholic Church in some other countries has done the same, but the Vatican has never done this, nor the hierarchy in Italy. So they did, back now over 20 years, about 25 years ago, come up with a statement under John Paul II called We Remember, because of the pressure about the silence of the Pope during the Holocaust. And We Remember is basically a whitewashing of this history. It's saying that, yes, there was anti-Judaism in the church. My sons and daughters in the church doesn't talk about popes in the official church over the centuries. But this had absolutely nothing to do with the demonization of Jews that could have led to the Holocaust. And this just is not true. I mean, that if you look at the kind of demonization of Jews that was going on in Europe leading up to the Holocaust, the church organs took part in this, and it reflected many arguments that had been made in the church. So, you know, it remains a difficult history for the church to come to terms with. I would just add that as somebody who works in Italy, it's also been a difficult history for Italy to come to terms with. It's not just the church. You know, that if you spend much time in Italy, you get the impression from people that Italy sided with the Allies during World War II, not with Hitler during World War II. So, you know, the church, and especially back then, was overwhelmingly Italian. You know, it maybe participates in this larger denial of this history.
Well, the last question I have for you is the legacy of Pope Pius XII after the war.
Well, after the war, he turned major attention. Now, if we're talking about the political sphere, obviously there's various theological sphere where he did important work from the point of view of the church. But first of all, it's not something I'm expert in myself. But if we focus on the political sphere, the fear that the communists would come to power in Europe was really a dominant fear right after the war. And of course, the beginning of the Cold War shortly thereafter. And this actually is something I've been working on since I completed this new book. I spent the spring working in Vatican archives on the immediate post-war period, where, among other things, in 1949, the Pope decides to excommunicate the communists. And this, some view, is rather ironic, given that he never excommunicated Hitler or Mussolini and so on during the war. But they announce that they're excommunicating all communists. And they are working behind, not only behind the scenes, but to some extent publicly, to, first of all, in Italy, prevent the communists from coming to power, because there was a lot of concern that the communists, together with the socialists, would come to power in Italy right after the war, but also more generally in Europe. So the Pope certainly was very politically active after the war as well.
Is the sainthood effort for Pius XII more about Vatican II than it is about actual Pius XII's conduct during the war?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think if one's trying to get at motives, I think it's a legitimate question. And I would think for a lot of people, whether they admit it or not, this really is what this is all about the change and major change in direction the church has gone to with the Second Vatican Council, with the recognition of the importance and equal dignity, you might say, of other religions. I mean, under Pius XII, the policy opposing any interfaith efforts remained. Catholics weren't allowed to go to meetings with not only Jews, but, you know, Protestants. This was seen as a bad thing. So it was a sea change that came in the church in the Vatican with the Second Vatican Council. And there are certainly those in the church for whom that last pope before that change, Pius XII, becomes kind of emblematic of what the church, the true church, really consisted of and should remain.
Well, thanks, Dr. Kurtzer. I really appreciate it. The Pope at War, a secret history of Pope Pius XII, Mussolini, and Hitler. It's really fascinating. Thank you for your time today.
Oh, good to be with you.
I would like to thank my guest once again today, historian and Pulitzer Prize-winning author, Dr. David Kurtzer. And if you would like to get his new book, The Pope at War, The Secret History of Pius XII, Mussolini, and Hitler, simply click on the link in the description below. Of the book, Daniel Silva on the Today Show said, The Pope at War is the most important book ever written about the Catholic Church and its conduct during World War II. Our featured brew was Pope's Imperial Pumpkin Ale from the Millersburg Brewing Company of Millersburg, Ohio. If you enjoyed our talk today, please share this episode with a friend. And remember, subscribe to the podcast. If you'd like more information on the authors and the books, like the History of Go-Go Facebook page. The music was provided by Rob Dufresne and the talented North Carolina band Bones Fork. And if you'd like to know what they have going on or check out some of their music, just click on their link. It's in the description below as well. Finally, to the thousands of listeners from around the globe, whether you're from Indianapolis, Indiana, or Sholo, Arizona, or from Calgary or Helsinki, thank you. There are many more great episodes on the way. So join us again next time when we talk, think, and drink on History A Go-Go.
Although he was dedicated to peace, the world was on the threshold of another war as the reign of Pius XII began. More than ever, his inspirational influence would be needed. Despite the turmoil of war, the busy routine of the Pope's life in the Vatican City was undisturbed. A routine that involved working an 18-hour day, 7 days a week, giving audiences, and administering the vast and complex organization of the Catholic Church.